Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. My name is Jesse Eisinger. I'm a senior reporter here at ProPublica. And my guest today is star of stage screen, the airwaves, Adam Davidson, founder of Planet Money.
Co-founder, yeah.
Co-founder, yes, right. Currently the host of the podcast Surprisingly Awesome, which is unsurprisingly awesome. I encourage you all to listen to it. And most recently, coming off of an amazing consulting gig on the movie The Big Short, directed by his friend Adam McKay.
Who is also the co-host of Surprisingly
who
Awesome.
Who is also, exactly. There we go. So it all comes around. Adam was a key member of the team that helped write and produce the series that I wrote on Magnetar, a hedge fund that was building CDOs to fail with a colleague here, Jake Bernstein, and we did a This American Life episode. And that was probably one of the highlights of my career. So thank you for joining us, Adam.
Thank you, and one of the highlights of my career, too.
So I want to hear about your gig on The Big Short. Tell us how it started and what you actually did for The Big Short.
Sure. So you and I have known each other a long time. We both covered the financial crisis, and we remember the deep challenge. I mean, you and I spent hours in offices trying to figure out, how do you explain what a CDO is? How do you a collateralized debt obligation, one of these toxic assets that were central to bringing down the global economy? How do you explain how so many people on Wall Street got it wrong? And did they get it wrong on purpose? Or were they stupid? Were they criminal? And this is kind of the background that you and I share. This is what we have spent much of the last decade thinking about.
Metaphors. How many metaphors did we try to come up with?
A lot of metaphors. Yes, exactly. CDOs. We were in rooms filled with metaphors. And so anyway, I kind of thought the financial crisis was behind me. I spent years deeply focused on it. And one day my brother, Eben Davidson, who's a senior vice president at Paramount Pictures, called me up and said, "Hey, you know Adam McKay?" And I was like, "Of course, he's hilarious. He wrote and directed Anchorman, Step Brothers, Talladega Nights." And my brother said, "Oh, he is now directing The Big Short, and he's looking for someone who knows about finance and the financial crisis. Would you talk to him?" I was like, "Well, yeah, I'll talk to him." And I guess I assumed it would be kind of a goofy Anchorman-like, Ron Burgundy-like, goofy take on Wall Street. But within 2 minutes of talking to McKay, it was this amazing conversation. I think he always says, like, "Oh, wow, I can't believe our finance guy was actually funny." But I also couldn't believe how serious and smart and informed the comedy writer director was. And I sort of like sucked into the process. This is early 2014, so like 2 years ago. I soon flew out to LA, and I spent much of 2014 either on the phone or sitting in a room with McKay, just going over the script line by line.
Wait, now, it's often journalists may, I don't know if this is the case with you, think of ourselves as a little bit of, you know, frauds. Like, I knew enough to write that article, but I don't actually know about this thing. So when you were asked to be a consultant, you didn't think, "I'll call up a Wall Street guy I know and or call up a real reporter, financial reporter like Eisinger or anything like that?"
You're right. Yeah. Well, luckily, I knew enough. First of all, I did call real Wall Street people. I called all the real characters in The Big Short. And there were definitely times where I was like, "I don't know how to answer that question." But I am a reporter. I know how to find out the answer to a question. But like, I think the hardest thing to do with finance in general and with this financial crisis in particular is place it in a narrative frame to sort of understand how these various people at the Wall Street banks, at the mortgage brokers, people who got houses, how they were understanding the world when they made the choices they made, how those choices were made. And I think you and I and, you know, a few dozen other people, but not a few hundred other people, spent a lot of 2007 and 8 and 9 and 10 trying to learn how to talk about that, how to think about that. And that, to me, is what paid off, is that trying to really understand the narrative, the emotion, the who was involved, why were they involved, et cetera. The specifics, like what is this deal or that deal or how was this kind of financial product structured? I mean, that's raw information that I didn't necessarily have access to and I would have to find out. But I think you and I, without realizing it, were preparing to do a Hollywood movie about Wall Street.
I mean, that's really fascinating because, of course, Wall Street – there are two things going on with Wall Street. One is that they have their own vernacular and just because they're an insular community. But the other thing is that they use technical jargon and opacity to obfuscate what they're actually doing. An important part of the business is to make it sound more complex than it does, than it actually is. Yeah, but then you need to have some of that to reflect the actual business, but the script also needs to be understandable to a human being.
Exactly. And again, when we talk about this thing called a CDO, like, it was literally designed to make it hard to make a movie about or hard to talk about in 5 minutes on a podcast. Because when a financial product is easy to describe, like a stock or a bond, which have their own complexities, but you could probably convey it pretty quickly. A stock is a small share of ownership in a company. A bond is an IOU. You're borrowing money. Then it becomes a commodity, and then all the Wall Street firms are competing for cost, basically. And so their margins, the profit they make selling them, goes way down. But when there's something really complicated called a CDO, and the language of it is all these weird words, obligors and tranches, and then I'm sitting across from a Morgan Stanley or a Goldman Sachs salesperson. Well, that guy knows all this stuff. I don't know all this stuff. And he's telling me it's going to cost me whatever, 103 cents on the dollar or whatever. I just have to pay that because he's a genius and he knows that stuff. And I have no ability. I don't know how to compare it to anything else. I think mattresses work that way from what I understand. It's like Sleepy's and all these different companies. None of them sell the same mattress, even if it's from the same manufacturer.
No,
it's like,
of course, totally different.
Totally different. Yeah. And then I think probably the single biggest sort of emotional arc that I impacted on the movie, and a lot of the characters in the book and the movie, you know, and the book tells the story of sort of four vaguely related groups of people who were shorting the housing market, who were betting against the housing market. And I think for McKay, for me, when I first read the book, they're just kind of four of the same people. Like, they're all doing the same thing. And as I got into this project, I realized there's two guys who were betting against the AA tranche of some of the bigger CDOs. Everyone else was betting against the BB, BBB tranches. Mostly,
and the AA was more highly rated, thought to be safer. And this is Jamie and Charlie.
That's Jamie. Yeah, Jamie Bay and Charlie Ledley. And what made this financial crisis so devastating was not that there were risky financial assets that went bad. That happens every day. Wall Street is built to withstand risky assets going bad. And so most of the shorts were shorting the riskier part of these mortgage products. And they definitely did worse than they were supposed to, and they were way riskier than they were supposed to be. But it still was sort of in the universe of the Wall Street I thought existed before this crisis. When you're shorting AA and even AAA bonds, that's not just a bet against that product. That is a bet against the whole system. That's betting against the regulators. That's betting against the SEC, against government's ability to regulate. That's betting against the banks themselves. And that was a big idea that I was excited to convey. Like, this, there's a moment where this shifts. And I think you feel that in the movie, where there's, like, in the beginning, the first third or so, it really is a caper film. It's like Ocean's 11 or something. Like, a bunch of guys, it is all guys.
Yeah, quirky misfits.
Right. Who figured out how to steal money from the bank vault, basically. And you're kind of rooting for them, and it's fun. And then it takes this tonal shift, and it's suddenly, oh, them winning is all of us losing. And
yeah.
And it's not just losing money in this year. It's the country we thought we lived in isn't the country we were living in. You know, the world I thought I lived in isn't the world we lived in. And so that, you know, I think probably for McKay, I would guess, like, my main input was just helping fact check and get things accurate. But for me, that idea, that was what I was excited to talk to him
yeah,
about.
Yeah, the movie does a masterful job of turning at the end. In fact, better than the book at kind of taking us to where the conclusions would be, which is, wow, there was massive fraud. The system was deeply, profoundly flawed, if not criminal in many aspects. And so, in fact, I think the movie does a better job than the very good book. But I want to return to this idea in a second. But first, I want to talk about the explanatory power of the movie. And I think that, you know, Planet Money deserves an enormous amount of credit for bringing real language and explanatory power to financial and business journalism. You and Alex Bloomberg are fantastic at that. So you were perfect to consult on this. What the movie does is it breaks the fourth wall with these now celebrated, justly celebrated, scenes of celebrity cameos where they explain stuff. Margot Robbie and then Selena Gomez and Anthony Bourdain and Richard Thaler, The Economist. How did those come about? Did you have anything to do with them? Can you want to take credit for them entirely now?
I do want to, but that would be inaccurate. No, I mean, it was his idea from the beginning. I mean, from when I came in, Adam McKay said his model was a movie I already loved, 24-Hour Party People, which by Michael Winterbottom, that is about, I don't know music at all, but it's like Depeche Mode.
The raves.
Or something like that, in England in the 70s.
Right.
But Steve Coogan is the star. And there's a lot of him breaking the fourth wall and sort of talking to the audience. And so McKay had that idea fully formed long before I got involved. I think I wrote, I can't remember. I definitely wrote a draft. And mine were always more complicated. You know, I wrote, I mean, they're short scenes. I mean, 40 seconds, 50 seconds, you know, and even the short stuff I did at Planet Money was still 5 minutes long. And most of the stuff we did was 15, 20 minutes. For This American Life, we'd do an hour. So, and I think what I learned a lot is the power of visual storytelling. I mean, I'm a print and radio journalist. I just never tell stories with pictures. And like when Anthony Bourdain is showing you how to make fish stew as a metaphor for the CDO, that just takes care of a whole lot of writing. I mean, you just see things. So I got to be honest, I was fairly skeptical of them when they were done on the script, when they were still on paper. I mean, I felt like, okay, I don't think we're actually explaining much here. I think it's, but when I actually saw them, I was like, oh, yes, okay, I get it now. I mean, those would have been places where I was very, you know, obviously it's McKay's script, but I was very actively involved in like writing drafts and sending them back. And Richard Thaler, who's, I was about to say the Nobel Prize winning economist, I think he's, if there's any economist alive today who should have already won the Nobel Prize, it's Richard Thaler. Uh-huh. I feel confident he'll get one, considered the father of behavioral economics. He had very strong opinions about the scene he's in with Selena Gomez.
Oh, really? Tell us about that.
When I called him to invite him to come down, first of all, I had to explain to him who Selena Gomez is. And I believe we had to explain to Selena Gomez who Richard Thaler is and
behavioral economics
is.
I'm shocked by that. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. And she didn't know behavioral economics either. What are they teaching Hollywood stars these days?
We went back and forth intensely over the script. And
well, so the blackjack metaphor is, I think, the best metaphor that you guys have in the movie because it show so well these side bets. And I have been, you know, trying to explain derivative side bets on CDOs for ages. And you just, the visual metaphor of people in the audience watching the game, watching the table, and then starting to make bets on the hands and starting to make bets on which hand was going to come in was really great. But McKay came up with the blackjack table and Thaler wanted to refine it. How did that work?
Thaler, he wanted to get a lot more ideas in. Like, so that scene, Selena Gomez is playing blackjack. And we're making the point that, so she's putting up her money at risk to try and get 21, closer to 21 than the dealer. But then all these other people watching her are making bets. And the whole idea is the impact of the cards falling and her losing money is felt throughout this little mini economy in the casino. And that's a big idea, as you just said. That's a huge idea in this financial crisis. You know, one of the mysteries for a lot of the big suits like Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, other, you know, very well-established, well-respected economic leaders was, wait, housing is only 5% of our economy. Subprime housing is a fraction of that. How can this tiny little thing bring down the whole economy? The math doesn't add up. And this is one of the reasons the math adds up, because many subprime houses, the impact of them were magnified by all these side bets. And so that's a big idea. That's a crucial idea. But Dick had all sorts of other ideas, like about correlation. And so he wanted Selena to have like three hands and showing how
they're in a crisis. They all correlate.
They
to
all
one.
Correlate to one, yes. Which is also an interesting idea. And also,
difficult.
So there are definitely times when there are lines that that are simpler than true, or like people say the thing that no one would actually say, like, I want to bet against the housing market. You know, like that Wall Street traders, yeah. Well, they wouldn't say that. But McKay was like, yeah, I know, but we need to help the audience along. And then there were times where either I or Dick Thaler would be arguing for a bigger idea or more ideas. And McKay would say, I think we're giving them a lot, you know? And I think he was right. Obviously, McKay was right. But that was contentious. Like, I'd say of all the people involved in the film, Brad Pitt, Ryan Gosling, Steve Carell, Christian Bale, Selena Gomez, Margot Robbie, Dick Thaler was tough, man.
All right. Let's talk about whether these guys are good guys or bad guys. And where you draw the line, because of course in the movie and in the book they come off as heroes, and then there are the guys like John Paulson and Magnetar who helped create CDOs, went to the banks, asked them to create CDOs, then filled them with crap and bet against them, unbeknownst to the people who ended up buying them. You know, where do you draw the line? And do you think about these guys as having performed a public service? Are they heroes? Were they mere opportunists? Is this actually, are they anti-heroes? Are they bad guys who did something bad for the system? And if they're good guys, are the Magnetar John Paulsons of the world bad guys?
Right. So first of all, I would say that for me is that one of the things that makes this movie more than just like a acted documentary or something that makes it actually great art. And obviously I've drunk the Kool-Aid fully. I really love this movie. Is that I think it messes with our expectations. It's like it follows the arc, like I was saying earlier, of an Ocean's 11. It follows the arc of, oh, those are the kind of rapscallion weirdo bad guys who are actually we love and we can't wait for them to win. And just at the moment when we're supposed to feel the most satisfied, like they finally have their just desserts. They finally beat the antagonist.
Right. They make their score.
They make their score, and we realize how horrible their winning is.
It's not satisfying.
Yeah, exactly. People talk about leaving the theater very angry. And I think, of course, some of that is, or most of that is anger that this financial crisis happened. But I think McKay is just amazing at creating that moment of anger because he's messed with our own expectations of what a film is.
Right. And for a Hollywood movie to end on such a bittersweet note is a big
it's
risk.
It's gutsy, yeah. Yeah. No, I'm just amazed how he made so many choices to stick to the integrity of his vision and the material. I remember once at the end of the financial crisis talking to you, Jesse. I don't know if you remember this, but it's like I'm just trying to figure out, because when I did the giant pool of money with Alex Bloomberg, this hour-long explanation of the financial crisis, that was very much the system was at fault. And then the reason I approached you about doing something with ProPublica is I was like, but that's not the whole story. I mean, I think that there were real systemic problems, but there was also real evil bastards. And I remember calling you, must have been 2011, I don't know, and just saying like, here's where I am. Do these numbers sound right? And I said, I think there's like between 12 and 100 people who actively, consciously, maybe didn't know everything that would happen, but knew something really bad was happening, knew that they could make choices to lessen the impact and instead made choices to enrich themselves. And I remember you saying, yeah, that sounds around right. Maybe it's a dozen, maybe it's 50, something like that.
Yeah.
And then I said,
I put a little bit more, but okay, yeah. Yeah, 100, 200, yeah, sure.
Maybe, yeah. And then there's maybe several thousand people who were really in positions to know something shady was going on and maybe didn't actively make the situation worse, but certainly had a stunning lack of curiosity and really did not fulfill their job. So this would be CEOs, this would be managers of those dozen or two dozen, this might be people on the desks working with those. And there I think we're talking 2,000-3,000 people, maybe more, 10,000. And then there's, you know, I mean, I think 500,000 people were working in finance at the time. So most of them, 450,000, had no idea. They didn't even know what any of this was. So of the characters in The Big Short, I think Jamie and Charlie, and I did know them before. They are friends, so maybe I'm biased. But I think they fulfill every criteria of hero. They truly tried to stop it. They went to the SEC. They went to the press. They really tried to alert the authorities and were laughed out of many offices. Once they did make a lot of money, they spent it on trying to reform the system. You know, they funded the Tobin Project and other projects. So I feel like I'm very comfortable saying Jamie and Charlie are heroes, full heroes, not even ironic heroes, sad heroes. They're just full heroes. I think that Michael Burry, Danny Moses, Vinny, they have spoken out enough since. They have been a public voice for reform and against Wall Street. You know, Danny and Vinny are the reason this book exists, this movie exists. They are the ones who sold Michael Lewis on the story. You know, Michael Lewis says he wrote it for Danny and Vinny. Like, on the hero scale, they'd kill me if they hear this, but I feel like they're maybe a notch less heroic.
They'd kill you because they don't want to be thought of as heroes, or because they don't want to be thought of less as heroes?
I think they both
Jamie
don't want to be
Trump.
Thought of as heroes, but if anyone's going to be thought of as heroes, they don't want other people to be thought of as heroes. And then I, you know, I don't think the Ryan Gosling character, Greg Lippen, I don't think he's a hero at all. I think he's probably a bad doer. I do think, and this is Felix Salmon's big argument, that when Michael Burry creates this shorting mechanism, he's prolonging the crisis. And when you short a stock, when you bet against a stock, you're taking an action that could potentially bring that stock down in value. And that might not be a bad thing if it's a crappy company and you're the one bringing attention to it. But the way mortgages work is different. Like that thing we talked about before, the kind of casino-like betting on the betting on the betting,
yeah,
is actually enabled by the bets against the housing. When you bet against housing, at least in the way these guys did, you actually might be contributing to the size of the crisis and the severity of the crisis. But I don't think we get to then call them bad guys. I don't put them in that bucket of people who are consciously making a choice to worsen the crisis. I think that's a hindsight is 2020 view. But what do you think?
Well, first of all, Burry wants to go out and short existing things. So that's a big difference, because he says, let me do this, figure out a way for me to short this thing. I do think that has some prolonging effect. But one is shorting something that exists. And the other thing is that he's not suborning any misleading deception on the part of the banks. When you get to Magnetar or John Paulson,
yeah,
in the case of Abacus, what they do is they approach the banks. They say, we want you to build this thing for us. We're going to make it look, in some cases, like we are buying it, because we're buying the equity tranche, the riskiest bottom piece. And then secretly, we're going to do two things. We're going to stash it full of crap, unbeknownst to the buyer, and we're going to short it, unbeknownst to the buyer. And you, bank, go out and sell it, but don't mention it to anybody.
Right.
That we've actually
asked you. And there is no way
–
and people should definitely go listen to the This American Life that you did, betting against the American Dream. Or
yes.
Which goes into this in great detail. But yes, John Paulson, Magnetar, they are sitting in a room and they are discussing a trade, making a deal that only works if they defraud other people, if other people make a bad decision. And I don't think any of the characters in the big short are doing
that. And other people wouldn't have made the same decision had they known.
Lots of other people could have made the decision and did not.
Yeah.
So yes, I think that's – I also think that one of the problems with securities law, the law that covers is something criminal or not, is it doesn't follow common sense morality. It follows arcane technical rules. I can't shoot you in the head and then like there's like a bunch of people, well, he did announce in a filing that he was going to shoot him in the head. I don't know what you do
the
about
hypothetical
that.
Hypothetical that if I had a gun, I might.
And so that to me, and
be
I
warned.
Know there might be a book coming out soon about this, but
someone should write a book about this.
We showed the movie to two groups of economists early on. Like there was a moment when the movie was locked, when it was done, and I was the only person with a finance background who had seen it. And I was like, I think it's pretty good, but I really want to know. And so we got some screenings, and these are like Lord Mervyn King, who ran the Central Bank of England.
I had the pleasure of attending one
of these. Jesse Eisinger of
ProPublica. One of the non-economists, one of the interlopers.
And as you remember, and this was very mainstream, Mark Gertler, who was Ben Bernanke's co-writer on many of his big – so this was like fairly mainstream. There were a couple farther left, like Anat Admati. The unanimous view was that that the greatest short failing in this crisis is no one went to jail. That was what every single person agreed on, which surprised me.
Well, on that note, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a real pleasure.
This has been so much fun, Jesse. And thank you. I mean, I will say, while you got no money, you got zero glory, you did in many ways contribute to this movie and my ability to get a tiny bit of money and a whole lot of glory.
Thank you. I owe so much of the glory of my career to you. So thank
All
you.
Right.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another exciting episode of the ProPublica podcast.